What is your name, sir?
William Upton.
Thank you, Mr. Upton. The police is just hold on for a moment. I believe that the Honorable Mr. Neal will be conducting the hearing, so just hold on, and he will be with you as soon as he can get his paperwork and everything is in place. So just hold on, he will be with you shortly. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, sir. Would you state your full name and ABC number for the record, please?
William Upton, 128-149.
Thank you, sir. Okay, sir, you have a full story. It was on board of executive clemency this morning in regards to a paroling hearing. I'm going to introduce the members of the board that are going to be conducting your hearing at this time. To my very far right is the Honorable Michael Johnson. To his left is the Honorable Dale Rittenhouse. To her left, the Honorable Dr. C.T. Wright, who is our board chairman. To my left is the Honorable Louis Ginnellis. My name is David Neal, and I'll be the hearing lead this morning. So, sir, what we're going to do is I'm going to go over some information about your case and make sure that we have pretty much in all the information in order. Then I'll go over a brief synopsis of the offense, and then we'll let you tell us in your own words about what's been going on and why you're a good candidate for parole at this time. Okay, you understand that, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So you're 75 years old now, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you're serving a series of 6 12-year sentences for attempted molestation of a child. They began in May 6th of 1997, and all are flat sentences. The first three sentences are consecutive, and then the last three are all consecutive to 803 with a third charge, which makes them concurrent to each other. So once you go into the last block of three charges, there'll be a total of 12 years involved with them. The sentencing structure had you, your original sentence was a total of 48 years. So your first 12-year sentence, the AO1, expired on May 5th, 2009, and you began the concurrent 12-year sentence, AO2, at that time. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You became eligible for parole on May 5th, 2015, and you were certified for this hearing, which is for absolute discharge of parole to max consecutive sentence, which would be 803, on May 1st, 2018. Your SED on the current sentence is May 4th, 2021. So if you have to serve the entire sentence, you would go until May of 2021 and then they'll automatically move to 803. You trying to say something, sir?
No.
Okay, I thought you were trying to say something, sorry. You've been before the board 12 times and been denied parole each time. So, at that point, does that sound correct?
That sounds about right.
Okay, and you did accept a plea agreement which stipulated that the sentencing would date from May 6, 1997. So, yes, you have some programming, but not that since 2008, during your incarceration. And in a couple of moments, I'll talk to you about some statements you made in a letter that you sent in for your last hearing in November about programming and stuff. But we'll discuss that in a couple of minutes. But as far as during incarceration, you've taken a few things, but not a whole lot. And last that you took inside was in 2008. There are no current letters of support from anyone, and I don't believe there's anyone in the audience today that's here in support of you. You have no prior criminal record, and your discipline has been rather commendable since you've been in, haven't had anything since 2001. There was one ticket, I think it was in 2005, but it was dismissed, so we won't count that one. So, we have letters from the victim and the victim's family, but they were dated for your November 2017 hearing, but I believe those letters were intended to be included in future hearings. There's a letter from you, which was dated November 30th, 2017, and it was included in the last hearing, and that's the letter I was talking about, talk about in a minute. To an office involved a continuous molestation of your own daughter from the time she was four until for about 10 years. So the offenses were between 1978 and 1988. You subsequently pled guilty to the six counts of attempted child molest, and all six of those counts occurred in 1987. So all the charges involved with your sentencing and hearing certification, everything are based on a date in 1987 rather than that clear back to 1978. Okay, sir, does that sound about correct to this point?
Well, everything except that my molestation was not continuous.
Well, no, there was a 10-year time period where it happened frequently.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so real quickly, I'll go over this letter just a little bit. It basically talks about some of the fact that you got some degrees and everything, some education that you got before you were sentenced to prison, correct?
Yes, I have a master's degree in education with a reading endorsement.
Okay, you had all that before you were sent to prison, correct?
Yes.
Okay, that's the reason that when the board brings up information is that we don't see that. We don't have any records of that, any way to really denote that in these hearings. So we have to rely on what you've done since you've been incarcerated, and that's actually more important to us than what happened before as far as your education goes. We have a lot of inmates that will take programming that's offered by Department of Corrections, but they also will take courses through the various community colleges around. And on that programming, you would have to document by sending us certification certificates. So that's why in the past you learned from the board that you don't have much in the way of programming. It's not that you don't have any education, it's you haven't done much since you've been incarcerated. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, that's now what we looked at another thing. You said that we give little credence to a prison record, which by statute you should be considered. We do consider that, sir, and we consider that as part of the big picture, if not the entire thing we look at, but it is considered. But our primary thing is not your behavior in prison or any of that. It is how we feel about the safety of society if you were released back into the community. That's our primary concern is the safety of others. Will you become a repeat offender or not? So what you're doing inside is a part of it, but it is not the big picture. It's part of the big picture, okay?
I understand that.
Okay. And you also make the accusation that we seem to have made up our minds tonight, you parole before the hearing commences, making what you say is a waste of time. Well, you're entitled to your opinion, sir,
I know it is incorrect, but if you feel that about these, that it's a waste of time to appear in these hearings, that's your right. What you can do so that you don't have to waste your time is to, when you get the paperwork giving you the date of the hearing, sign the lower half, not the upper half, and that waives your right to appearance, and you don't have to come to the hearing. So you don't have to waste your time.
Right.
Okay, so...
I did that for the last 10 years.
Okay, so... now, it talks about our charge. We don't charge you with not having any family or community support. You said it's not altogether true, and we understand we may have some people out there, but we don't have any record of it. We would like to see if you're planning on living with a relative or in a halfway house or wherever you might be planning on living, we'd like to see some kind of documentation to that, okay, like a letter or somebody showing up in the hearing, okay? And so without those sort of things, we have to make an assumption that you don't have any real support. And, you know, it doesn't mean you don't have any. It means that we don't see any or sufficient to be sure that you're going to be kept on a straight and narrow when you get out. So, now, we do have that information in the letter, and everything. So I just wanted to hit those few points so we don't have to, you know, get in any kind of elongated discussions for a few minutes. So with all that being said, sir, now I'm going to give you an opportunity to tell us what's been going on. We'd like to, you know, hear about you know, what was going on in your mind and your life back when the fences were going, and something about that. We also want to know what you've been doing in the last 6 months to help prepare you to become a good candidate for parole back into the community. Because with a sentence, you know, going to that consecutive sentence, it puts you closer to being out there. And, you know, with today's technology and everything, you still have an possibility of getting done with your sentences or getting far enough along that your parole will be to the outside, not to the next consecutive. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, so it's your turn.
Have your attention. First of all, the term agreement. When I came to prison, what they call over-educated, and I had already had experience for 9 years as an educator, and particularly as a reading specialist. I also had 12 years' experience as a writer-editor. And so I became very involved in helping other inmates and teaching and helping them read the comprehension. I became very involved in writing position papers. I did a lot of writing in prison. And I've even written a book, and I really didn't see any programming that I consider would be able to help to me. And my counselors really recommended anything for me. And when I did, I took the programming. I did start the SLET program. Here at South Unit, but in the second place they removed the instructor from the yard. So I didn't make it through all the modules. Now, the last 3 years, far as the offense goes, before I came to prison, I knew that I was, my offense is wrong. I tried over the years during my tenure for it to stop. I managed to stop for a few years. I even talked to my daughter about it. She knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong. And by 89, I think it was, I repented of my offenses against my daughter. And I lived in Europe for 7 years before I came to prison as a temporary member and without reattending. And since I've been in prison, I've become less harmful. I've become more more self-controlled. I have no obsession with sex. I'm sexually abstinent. I have been since the first year in prison. And I have no sexual preoccupations, no sexual obsessions, and I don't indulge in any sexual activity. Putting it simply, I'm not a danger to anybody. I'm not dangerous. I'm harmless. And I know in my own heart I would never reattend. I have been battling cancer for about three years. For the last 2 years, I've been too sick and too weak to remain employed. I become more and more sick and weak. The oncologist had diagnosed the cancer as incurable, stage 4, and terminal. I don't believe that myself, but that's what they diagnosed it as. And I'm currently in chemo. I've been in chemo since February. And the chemo has taken its toll on me. I nearly died twice, once in April and once last week. But the oncologist told me Monday that the treatment is working, that my blood protein levels have been reduced from 18 to 3. They should be 1. And so I'm continuing another cycle of treatment. I have no idea what's going to happen after this cycle.
Yes, sir.
Each cycle had...
Sir? I hate to interrupt you. What type of cancer do you have?
It's multiple myeloma / lymphoma.
Okay, so can you tell me that in layman terms?
It's a bone marrow blood type cancer.
Okay, so it's kind of like a leukemia type?
Kind of like a leukemia. The proteins in my blood are eating up my bones.
Okay. My understanding of those is that they sometimes contribute with stem cell implantation. So
that would be, there are treatments out there, either new or experimental, that would work to get rid of my cancer, but I don't believe Christ will ever approve them because they're so costly. Or they're still experimental.
Okay.
Well, there is, currently with the treatment you're getting and everything else like that, what's your prognosis? What do they say your chances of survival are, or what is that?
They would be attempted with a biomedical medical record. They don't tell me what that is. They didn't even tell me that it's, they don't have a medical record. They diagnose it as incurable, stage 4 and terminal.
Okay, but they don't have an estimated like 6 months live or 18 months prognosis, anything like that. They just say it's incurable.
I have some information on that that some friends have sent me from out the street. And I think this type of cancer, I think the last I read it was 5 years.
Okay.
So, and I've had it about 3 years.
Okay. Let's move on to another, or back to another subject about programming. You say that if council recommends it, you take it, but you don't go out looking for programming within? Because I don't see any sort of sex offender programming included in your, you know, in the programs that you've taken in fire, and I'm sure you didn't take any of those while you were getting your master's or anything.
No, I took I went through the first phase of orientation at the SOATP at Ryan Unit. I think it was in the year 2000. And in the early 2000s here at South Unit, after the trailer door brought it up, I enrolled in the second phase, and I went through A, B, and C of that phase, I believe it was. I think there were 4 modules, A, B, C, and D.
Okay, so is there any chance that you can get into the SOATP course there where you're at right now?
Well, they usually take those inmates that are near release, but I know that I know what the program consists of from the person I went to, and it's a lot of mind stuff, you know, changing your mind and psychological stuff, and I've already done that. I retired of my offenses. By the grace of God, I overcome. I don't have any sexual arousal or sexual attraction as I used to have. And in fact, through self-control and self-denial, I don't even allow myself to look at anything or see anything that would make collision in that way.
Okay, but you know, do you use the term they use, you know, the psychologist everybody uses, the pedophile? All the studies and almost every expert, no matter which side of the fence, drawn out there and say the same thing, is that pedophiles are almost totally incurable, and that they have to learn new behavior, they have to learn what sets them off, they have to learn all that to be successful in not reoffending. And that's one of the reasons we like to see, like the SOETP course, it helps you identify triggers. And even at your age, we get inmates appearing on parole that committed their crime when they were your age, you know, the crime that they got caught for. And it's another thing, you know, you did that when I say continuously, it may not have been day for day for day, but it was, you know, an ongoing problem that you had for at least 10 years, and you started when your daughter was 4.
So it's got to be something going on with that. And, you know, self-denial is fine, but if you don't get an outside source to help you identify your triggers and everything, your self-denial can be turned into self-gratification real quickly on the outside, because there's a lot of stuff that's available out there that you can't get where you're at currently. And a lot of it you get accidentally. And then once you've been exposed to it, you may not be able to have the self-control to stay away from it. So I'm going to see if my fellow board members have any questions at this time. Okay? So hang on a minute. Questions? Ms. Whitmore.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Upton, is it true that the original charge, and I look at the plea agreement, that there were originally 32 counts?
It's how many?
On the crime. The originally there were 32 counts.
Oh, I don't remember that.
And the plea agreement dismissed 28 of them. So you're serving your sentence is based on only 6 of 32 counts that you were charged with.
No, I recall there were only 6 counts on my charges.
Well, there is paperwork here that says states otherwise, that 28 counts were dismissed at the time of your plea agreement. So you have completed part of the, another question, sorry. You have completed part of the sex offender program, and that is documented here, sir. It is documented that you completed the orientation part of part one and then part two, but you say you didn't complete part two, is that correct?
Almost. The instructor was transferred before we finished every module.
Okay, so it's because of staff leaving that you didn't finish it.
Right.
Okay, and then they didn't like bring in a new staff member to pick up where you left off. They just had you stop. Okay, well that's unfortunate. That's too bad. While you were in that treatment, did you discover what your triggers were? Because you say part of that is thinking about why you did it. What were your triggers?
I understand what my triggers were. I had, at the time in 1978, I had been married about 8 or 10 years, and I had fallen into a crash to the point where I allowed it. This may sound crazy to you, but after I came to prison, I sat down to an answer to why I did that, and he showed me that it was demonic, that I had fallen into the flesh and opened the door for a demon of lust. And I no longer have that.
Okay, so you don't have any feelings like that anymore?
No.
Okay, sir. And then one other question I had. You were you're a veteran, is that true?
Yes.
Okay. And what branch did you serve in?
The United States Air Force.
Oh, you were in the Air Force. Okay. And about what years? Do you remember?
So 1961 to 64.
61 to 64. Okay. All right, sir. Well, thank you for your service there. And that's all, Mr. Neal. Do you have any more questions?
Thank you. Mr. Canales.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Mr. Upton?
Yes, thank you.
I have a follow-up question, and it would seem that in the time that these crimes were happening, you were leading a deceptive life. You were actively engaged in your church, were you not?
Yes.
All right. You're saying you've repented now and again, not to commingle religion with government, but how could we possibly know that you've repented now if you were leading that lifestyle as a deacon in your church then? And my second question is, you said you fell into the ways of lust, but you fell into it in a pretty deviant way, with having a sexual relationship with your child daughter. That's a pretty big stretch, as far as falling into lust. When did the attraction to children come into play in your life, sir?
It happened mostly with my daughter in 1978, and it was devastating. And I lived with tremendous devastation and guilt throughout that period of time. And I struggled against that sin. And I finally cried out at the end, before I was separated from my daughter. I cried out for the Lord Jesus to deliver me. And that's when the deliverance happened. But by then it was too late. But I knew the damage I was doing. I was devastated by it. I had not only helped destroy her, but I helped destroy my family. I shipwrecked the whole family. So it was a really traumatic period of time. But I had repented. Over 7 years before I came to prison, and I had that 7 years to work out self-control and self-denial and start denying myself to get back out of the flesh. And by the time I came to prison, I was sexually abstinent. I didn't really begin during that 7 year period.
Well, sir, I hope that is true, because we have no way of knowing that. But thank you for being so candid with the board. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I thought of one more. Just one more. It's okay. I'm sorry. Mr. Upton, I thought of one more question, and it's something, you said something about being homeless, but your release paperwork indicates that you would live with friends in Gilbert if you were released. Are you still in touch with those friends, and are they still willing to have you live with them?
Yes, I just had a visit with them last Sunday.
Okay. So your comment about being homeless was just why did you make that remark?
I guess because I haven't talked to him about living there, I guess, but I'm sure he'll let me live there.
Okay, it just says you hope to reside with them, so you haven't really discussed it with them.
Yes, in fact, Ted Graham's wife is my power of attorney. I went to her about power of attorney.
Okay. Ken and Joanne Graham is who is mentioned here.
Who is that?
Ken and Joanne Graham. Is that the people?
Ken and Joanne Graham, right.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Neal. Thank you.
Dr. Wright. Okay. Thank you. Honorable Mr. Neal. Mr. Upton, let's go back before you were incarcerated. You said that you were an educator, and of course you had your master's degree and all of that, and commend you for the life style. But as an educator, what were you teaching? Were you teaching in public schools, or were you teaching at church? What were you involved with in terms of education?
My first 5 years, I was a self-contained classroom teacher from 5th grade to 8th grade. And my last 4 years, I was a reading specialist for elementary level.
Let me make an assumption, and then you correct me, sir, because I'm probably wrong, but I'm going to make an assumption that in both cases, both groups, the first as well as the last one, some of your students were female, young, just like your daughter. Did you have any desire for sexual contact with any of your students, sir?
No.
So at what point did you, I know it was your daughter, so when did you decide that that was, that she was going to do that with your daughter? When I say that, I mean have sexual contact. When, how did you decide that, sir?
I didn't decide, it just happened.
How did it just happen? Because you've been around young, you've been around females. It was just something that happened in your home.
That's what I didn't. That's what I didn't understand. That because when it happened, I was let's see, 40, close to 40 years old, 40-some years old.
Right.
And I'd never been like that before. And all of a sudden, it just happened instantly. I'd never had feelings or arousals like that before.
Once again, would you remind the board, how old was your daughter when this started?
She was very young when I first started. When I was first aroused, she was only 4. But I followed up any kind of interaction with her for years after that.
No.
There was a period of time when I went for 3 years without even touching her or anything.
I'm just trying to, some of this we probably talked about before, but I'm just trying to get to understand you a little better. Now, did you have any sexual contact with others during that period? I mean, you had sexual contact with your daughter. What about her mother or some others that you might have known? Did you have any, not necessarily young people, but were you having sex with others, or it was just that, just your daughter, sir?
No, just my daughter. She's the only victim.
I didn't mean victim. I mean someone else that you might have just falling in love with, or whatever terminology that one would like to use. But she was the only one that you were, but at the time of the offense, that you were actually having sex with, sir?
No, I never had a relationship with anybody except my daughter like that.
Okay, sir. And you say you wrote a book. What's your book about, sir?
It's a very large book about the
biblical end time. It's about end time prophecy from the Bible. Okay. I think you stated something to the effect, and I didn't write it down, but perhaps it might have been perceived by some professionals that there were demons in your life. Did you feel that way? Was it a demon that made you do this, or helped to facilitate this behavior on your part, or what was going on? Because you're a biblical, I'm going to be very, very broad and give you credit. You're basically a biblical scholar. You understand religion. You understand education. So it was. So something just happened, wrong word, but that force that coerced you into committing this type of act, sir, but you don't know what it was.
When I came to prison, I didn't understand it, and I did a lot of praying and praying, and it was in a dream that God showed me that it was a demonic thing, a demon of lust. And I know that sounds crazy, but that's all I can tell you.
Are you, and I don't mean necessarily a formal sense, but maybe in a formal sense, are you now, would you consider now that you are a religious person, or after all these years?
I don't consider myself religious. I do have a relationship with Jesus Christ, but I don't consider myself religious. But I love God and I love His Word.
And I know that, excuse me, go ahead, sir.
I know that He gave me grace to overcome where I used to be. I know how most people that live out there that either went to sex offender or was a sex offender, but I don't believe that, and I know that's not true. I see others overcome too.
In your own words, sir, and I think this will be my last question, Mr. Neal. In your own words, sir, how could you assure me as a board member, I'm not going to speak for other board members, but how could you assure me that if down the road you were released, that you would not commit this type of act again? How could you just assure, in your own words, sir?
Well, you know, I know in my own heart I wouldn't, but I would have to prove it by my actions. Because everything else to you would be subjective. You know, the people that know me, they know that I'm harmless. They know that I'm not a threat to anybody. They know I'm not a danger. You know, even the people on the outside, but, you know, I would
prove
about my actions, that's all I can say.
Let me just ask this. You said the people on the outside, who knew you aside from the Grahams? Who else do on the outside know you? You don't have to give names, but who might just know you, people who might know you on the outside, sir?
I still have friends that I used to attend church with in Yuma. I have friends that I used to go to all the way from Washington State. That I still correspond with. I have friends in Yuma that I still correspond with. My former pastor from the first church I attended in Yuma still comes to visit me twice a year, Sean Spigger. He's pastor of Heritage Baptist Church. He's my secondary contact in case of emergency. I have friends in Missouri. They used to live in Yuma, Dennis and Dixie Dion. She used to be my kind of attorney. I don't know, I just have several people that I still correspond with.
I'm glad to know that you still have friends out there, sir. So I'm going to stop at this point. Thank you so very much, and thanks for responding to the questions that I ask in such an intelligent way. Thank you so very much, Honorable Mr. Neal.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the board? Okay, Mr. Upton, while these other questions were going on, I remembered a couple of things from the, it's from the pre-sentence report when you had this going on before you were actually incarcerated. But in that, you made a statement to the parole officer that did the pre-sentence. And it says you said that you indicated you were attracted to certain types of females of all ages. And but you said that you were at that time you were strict with yourself, not allowing to fantasize, masturbate, or have sex. Okay, very commendable. When I asked if you had molested any other children, you said no. However, you did indicate that you had flirted with children in the past year and had been sexually aroused by the 7-year-old daughter of a family you had befriended. The family belonged to your church when you were a deacon, and what aroused you about the 7-year-old child was the affection that the child showed you. And you said in the same report that that's what got you started with your daughter, when she was very affectionate towards you, and that's what got you aroused. But in the meantime, between the beginning of this offense and now, actually, you've taken a very minimal part of any sex offender program and everything else is self-diagnosis. And, you know, a person with a master's degree, a lot of this stuff is stuff that you can read about and kind of, you know, like your own self-evaluation. But self-evaluation and something like this is absolutely not going to convince me that you won't reoffend, because when you get out, more than likely, if you're released back into society, if you get around children and they show affection, is that going to trigger you? We don't know. Because you've been away from it, but you haven't taken any substantial programming that might convince a counselor or psychologist, something like that, that you have mended your mental ways as far as how that affection affects you. So the assurance that you wouldn't, you know, do this again, or just I haven't heard anything to indicate that there is anything. It's all, you know, you keep talking about self-denial and self-this and self-that, but it's all stuff that you've formulated on your own without following through a regimented, accepted program that is supposed to help sex offenders not repeat.
May I respond to that?
Well, I mean, yeah, you can respond to it. That's what it's your hearing, and that's why we got this hearing, so you can respond to our questions.
If you really believe that programming would help me and do me good and make me, I consider myself completely harmless, but if you really believe that would make me more harmless, and that would assure you that I wouldn't reoffend, I would gladly take that programming. But I've been so simply a week from this cancer and the chemo, I don't know if I can endure any programming. I've been unemployed for 2 years, which I don't want to be unemployed. I wouldn't be working, but I'm too sick and too weak to work. In fact, for the last 6 months, I've been on a lay-in. And last week, I was so extremely ill that I was in bed all week. And I'm not sure that, I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know what effect the cancer or the chemo is going to have on me, but I'm not sure that I would have the energy or the strength to endure going to a class. Sometimes I can barely walk a few steps to medical.
Okay. I don't have anything else. Any other questions come up to the board? Okay, so we're nearing the end of your hearing, and like I say, it is your hearing. We'd like to give you an opportunity to make a final statement. Tell us anything else that you think we might benefit from in our decision, but we ask that you don't repeat all the information you've already covered. So now is your time for the final statement, sir.
Well, I appreciate you guys listening to me this time. It seems like you really don't want to listen to me more. And let me state my case. I really don't have anything else to say. I have been approved for retirement for Social Security. So I know it would be a financial burden on anybody on the outside. And if I was released, I know that I wouldn't be a danger or a threat to anybody in society. No matter what the temptations are out there, I know that I'm up to continuing just as I am without harming anybody or being a threat to anybody. And I did it a year ago before I came to prison, and I did it even better now.
Okay, thank you, sir. The board will be going into discussion. We'll be talking amongst ourselves. You may think we're talking to you, but we won't be. We'll be discussing your case. So we ask you to remain on the phone. Just remain silent while we're in discussion, and once we've made a decision, I'll get back with you. Okay, do you understand, sir?
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, the board is now in discussion. Well, this is... It's an unfortunate, very unfortunate situation, especially for the victim. And I just, I find a lot of discrepancies, if you will, or actually not be a discrepancy, just the way that Mr. Upton looks at things. He claimed that it was devastating to realize he was molesting his daughter, but to be here for 10 years. So then he was devastating for 10 years, and then she finally was able to convince him to leave her alone, and then when she got a little further up in age, she turned him in, and that whole time, it never devastated Mr. Upton enough to have him come himself in or even go out and seek some serious counseling for the problem. Everything was self-denial, self-quit, self-doubt, and I just, that to me is just not a sign that, the gentleman is really serious and his remorse regrets for the offense. And some of his own statements, yes, it's been since 1997 in Reagan, but it is unsettling to read the part where he felt the affection from the child when it's only as many as he's used to, is very loud, and he's done nothing other than introspectively since it occurred. I'm not in favor of total the next consecutive sentence for Mr. Upton. And also, I'd like to, at this point in time, bring it up for a discussion. Although the crimes that were being involved and indicted were started back in 1978, the crimes that he was in prison for happened in 1987. Which means, in my way of thinking, he's eligible for a one-year set-off, which he hasn't had. He had 1 year all the way through until the last two hearings, and he had 6 months on each one. So, my interpretation would be that it'd be a one-year set-off, and so I bring it up now in case there's any discussion on that part. But at this point, I'm not in favor of pulling much of the same, but I'd like to hear a discussion from any of my fellow board members. Ms. Rittenhouse.
Mr. Mayor, thank you. What's particularly troubling to me is just that that Mr. Upton had the facade of being a Christian and being active in his church and at the same time doing this activity. And I just haven't heard today, I haven't heard anything that would convince me that he would do otherwise. So I'm also with you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
I agree. And, the fact that he is incarcerated and that he has not had any of these feelings, but he stated in his report that, this incident with his biological daughter started when she was 4 years old. And it went over a long period of time, and he was aroused by her sitting on his lap. And there was one other incident where he did talk to other females. I just don't feel comfortable with thinking that he is released. I didn't think that he would be a danger to society, and that he wouldn't be likely to again if he was back out on the street.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Neal. Considering the lifetime of trauma caused by the victim, and I dare say, as I want to stick to the charges at hand, the possibility of other victims. He was given 4 consecutive sentences, plucked down from 32, with his last being a sentence for 3 concurrent charges. I think there's a reason why that part of the criminal justice system gave him such a stiff penalty, and I do not think that his current age is any indication that he's no longer harmed to our community. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Dr. Ryan?
Thank you, Honorable Mr. Neal. I agree with our colleagues, our distinguished colleagues, and I think that, you know, we do have to take into consideration the victim. I think that based on what we know and what we read, what we understand, is that the victim is, this will always affect that victim. I mean, this is a very unfortunate situation. To be sure, she was young at the beginning, but I'm sure that it falls for the rest of her life. And I think that as we look out for the interests of those in the state of Arizona, we have to look at the victims. And in this case, I think that this is a very unfortunate situation, and especially as he stated himself. I mean, he was 40 years old when he committed this, around 40 years age in that neighborhood. And I think, you know, to do this to a victim, to a daughter, this is just something that I cannot agree to move him to his next consecutive sentence at this time, sir. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, sir. I would like to make one other, say one other thing about this. Mr. Upton uses the information that all these people know think he's harmless. I must say that a great number of serial killers' friends all thought they were harmless. So that in itself is not anything that would convince me that he would not be a repeat offender. So at this point in time, based on all the information that we have been presented in the packet, Mr. Upton's statements and all our discussion, I'm going to move to deny Mr. Upton parole to the next consecutive sentence for absolute discharge at this time. And it would be with a 1-year set-off because the crimes that are being sentenced for all occurred after 1984.
Correct.
And that's my motion.
Second.
Agreed.
Motion by myself, seconded by Ms. Mittenhouse, and agreed by Dr. Genomis. Dr. Bates, Mr. Dunn. The reason would be that it was a serious and deviant offense, trauma to the victim, aid to the victim, and because of the continuing commission over a period of years, victim harassment. He has a criminal history. He has lack of programming for basically no release plan at time, which is understandable, but he's got no family or community support system that is in you can see. So what are the conditions? And if somebody else has something they'd like to include? Okay, so Mr. Upton, the board has unanimously voted to deny you a parole for your next consecutive sentence at this time. And it'll be a 1-year set-off, so in approximately a year, the DOC will certify you for another hearing. If you think it's a waste of time, you can waive your right to appear. But the hearings come up automatically as part of the law. Okay? Have you heard the reasons for denial? Are there any questions, sir?
Yes. The last report that you said for the hearing last year, you listed a new reason for denial, and it was victim harassment, but I, except for the sentence hearing, I haven't seen the victim in about 30 years, And I have an issue of no contact with her, so I would like somebody to explain why I get to harassment.
Because during the 10 years you were molesting her, you were, that is victim harassment, the continuous repetition of the crime, sir. Had nothing to do with the harassment. This one had nothing to do with any harassment after the charges came up. I'm not accusing you of having unlawful contact with her after you were convicted. I'm saying that while you were molesting her, that is considered harassment to the victim.
Okay, thank you.
All right. This will end your hearing, and we'll see you back in the home.
Thank you.